began when he was 33, and it took him 4 to 5 years, and it measures 40 meters by 14. So it's very big. 1508 to 1512. That's the years. Now, this ceiling is very significant because it contains many items from the Bible, and particularly the book of Genesis and the creation. And as you probably know, right in the center is this moment where God creates man. So there's God on the right and Adam on the left. And there's this moment where, in a sense, man becomes man. And God has brought some contact. And there's that tiny space that Michelangelo left. It's almost there. The divine human encounter. And of course, we know that it did occur. And it speaks to us of the importance that we have to have a relationship with God. The modern expression is, it's part of our DNA. It's part of us being human. To have that relationship with God, that divine human encounter. And surely that's why we're here this morning. We want to contact God. Now, we're doing that all week, I hope, that God is living in our lives. But some of us, perhaps, we haven't reached that point. But this is the most important thing for all of us, to be truly human, is to have God in our lives. Now, this is Blaise Pascal. And he said, there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man and woman and child which cannot be filled by any created thing, but only by God, the Creator, made known through Jesus. There is a God-shaped vacuum in each one of us. And we will not be complete. We will not be whole. We will not be truly human until that is filled by God Himself. Now, Blaise Pascal lived 1623 to 62, so he died at the age of 39. But he was a French philosopher, mathematician, scientist, and he did his major work, as some of you might know, on the pressure of liquids. And there is, of course, Pascal's law. And out of that, we get hydraulics. So when you drive away in your car, it's partly from Blaise Pascal. So he is a scientist, a top mathematician. But he was also a Christian. Another great book he wrote was his Penses, which talks about the relationship with God. And he says there that there are the two things, reason and faith. Both are important. And of course, a scientist is very much locked into reason. And Blaise Pascal said that reason can only take us so far. And he believed it is only faith, which is without limits, can really expand our being. So if you're just locked into reason, sad for you. So this morning, we're going to look at that divine human encounter, of what it means for God to be us to be confronted by God, to have a relationship with God, to have that first meeting, in a sense. Now, in the Bible, there are many instances of this, and they're all different. None of the same. And you're all different. And I'm not saying that because we're looking at this particular one, it will fit you. You might have to look at others. But here is one that may fit some of us, that helps us to understand this amazing thing that God can come to man. And it's in Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, or burning ones, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried. "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am. Send me." He said, "Go and tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes, otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed." Then I said, "For how long, O Lord?" And he answered, "Until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and the oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land." Isaiah chapter 6. Why chapter 6? Is it his conversion? I mean, why talk about your conversion when you've had five chapters talking about ministry and so on and prophecies, and then come in with your conversion? Well, it could be a good thing, because in a sense, all of us need to come back to our conversion experience. In the college I went to, people would want to leave. They'd be there a year or 2 years and they would go. It wasn't for me. And the principal would call them into his office and he would open up the file for when they first came to the college. And in the interviews, you had to fill in these forms, and one of them was, "How I became a Christian." And the other one was, "Why I feel God is calling me to ministry." And he read them out to them. It's always good to rehearse it when we come to communion. Remember the time when you first met the Lord. And if you're doing some kind of ministry, if you're involved in any kind of leadership, How did God speak to you? Remember it, and it will refresh you. So it's a call, a strengthening of his commitment, or a fresh encounter with God, deepening his awareness of God. And that's why, in a sense, we come to church. We're coming to the service that there may be that sense in which, yes, I know God, but there is that deepening encounter. Well, let's look at the context. The year that the king Uzziah died. So it's about death is in the first sentence. In November, I received news that my best man at our wedding died. In the Christmas cards and letters I got from friends in the UK, I had news of two of the students I was with at college have died. Now, what we're looking at is in this context, death. Now, some of you know about death and the terrible feelings and the loneliness. And some of us, well, I'm getting on. I think about death. And so this is the context that we have here. And it's not only the death of a person, it's the loss of a job. Because you not only lose the money, you lose the contacts and the friends. It's moving house. All those old neighbors you spent years working on, and you've got to start again. And so on and so on and so on. In a sense, everyone has an experience of death and little death. And this is the context here. So it's a time of crisis and uncertainty. Now, you probably all know about Uzziah. But Uzziah was the king of Judah. And he was on the throne from 783 to 742 BC. He came to the throne when he was 16, and he was on the throne for 52 years. Now, that gives a feeling of stability. It's a shock. I remember when Steve Irwin died, was killed. That was a major shock for me. But it's going to be a different kind of shock when Queen Elizabeth II dies. Because 65 years. All that stability. And she's known, 10, 12 prime ministers. We want a bit of stability here in Australia, don't we? We really do. But Uzziah was good because since the time of Solomon, there'd been only one other king where the country had been prosperous and there had been that sense of unity with God. That was Jehoshaphat. And the next one was Uzziah. Now, he did make a mess, and you know the story about the leprosy and so on, but the point is, for the people of the land, here's uncertainty. Change. What we may think about is the shaking of the foundations is going on. So this is the context. And this is the context where Isaiah sees the Lord. Watch out. God is about. One of the problems of certainly the end of the 20th century, was what some people called matiness with the Almighty. And it's dangerous to come into the presence of the living God. Do you really want to do it? He saw the Lord. Now, he sees the Lord in two ways. What we think about as transcendence, that God is far from us. And, all right, imminence, he is near to us. Now, this is, God is astounding. I mean, how can you be those opposites? Seems like a paradox, doesn't it? But there's deep mystery in the nature of God. He is both far and near, transcendence and immanence. And Isaiah gives us these images, please, thank you, of transcendence. He says he's on a throne. There's majesty and power involved there. A lot of thrones are placed on stairs, so they're even higher. And one of the tricks, of course, that emperors and kings have is that when you go to see them, you go to the door, and the door opens, and then you go into a room, and then you go into another big room, and then you go into another big room, and then you go, and you're feeling smaller and smaller and smaller as you go. So the throne is a very great expression of this power and majesty of God. And he's high and lifted up. He's exalted. He's holy, holy, holy. He's different and moral. So all these qualities are coming out in these images that Isaiah is seeing about God. Now, holy. Now, we have adjective, comparative, and superlative, don't we? Good, better, best. Never let it rest. Till your good is better and your better best. There we are. There we are. You got your adjective, your comparative, and your superlative. But they don't have that in Hebrew. So what they do is they repeat it. Holy, holy, holy. This is superlative. Oh, awesome, awesome, awesome. And then there are the images of immanence. Filled the temple. Now the temple is a series of boxes. In the center box, the Holy of Holies, only the high priest on the Day of Atonement could go. That was seen as very special. And then outside that is another box where the priests could go. And then there's another box where the Israelites could go. And then there's another box where the women could go. And then there's another box where the Gentiles could go. So when Isaiah says this presence of God fills the temple, there's no division between the high priest and the Gentiles. He's accessible to all. Goes on to say the whole earth is full of his glory. And here we come to those foundations. The foundation shook. Watch out. Watch out. God is about. And the house was filled with smoke. That total thing. He's everywhere. He is now here. Ah. Ah. I want an experience of God. Yes, I want a deeper experience of God. But there is danger. That's in case you didn't get it. And one of the dangers of having this relationship, this experience of God, is that we become aware of our sin. Isaiah says, woe is me. I am ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips. That's how he feels his expression of sin. He sees it in terms of his lips. And I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Sin. Difficult. What is sin? And people have different ways to explain sin. And one of them, a good little one, is actually sin. Got an I in the center. Sin, at its essence, is self-centeredness. Talking that to a fellow who's going to be a married man. Don't sit at the front. Okay. Another one, I think it was C.S. Lewis, is one that really sends shivers up my spine, talking about the nature of sin. Rats in the cellar. You know, in England, there are as many rats as there are people. But we don't see them. They're there, and they're not in the light. But they're around. It's like that advert about cockroaches. You only see one, but they're under there. And you've got to buy the stuff. But there are rats in the cellar. And although we may put on, you know, a face and so on, we know deep in our being there are rats in the cellar. Well, there are many different ways of talking about sin. And I want to bring one to you that comes from the writings of C.S. Lewis. This is an item that I had when I was looking in the internet. And it's written by a mother of five children who has degrees in physics and law. Now, C.S. Lewis, I don't know if you know, that he died on the same day Kennedy was assassinated. But great man. I first read C.S. Lewis after I arrived in the United States as a 9-year-old girl. Born in Iraq, I was still learning English when I first read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it captured my attention and my imagination. Life moved on. I settled into this country. I became an adult, and I later read other non-fiction and philosophical books by Lewis. But what breaks me, even to this day, are a few pages in his fiction book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. In these pages, C.S. Lewis offers us a powerful personal image of regeneration. The scene starts with Eustace, a rotten boy, there he is, Eustace Clarence Scrub, who has found himself in possession of a large fortune. You might be interested to know that that opening sentence came number 47 in the 100 best opening sentences of a book. See, are you taking notes? Good. This. Now, Eustace has found himself in possession of a large fortune. He imagines the life and comforts he can now enjoy, and in his comforts he falls asleep with his treasure. When he awakes, Eustace is no longer a boy, but a dragon, the outward manifestation of his inner greed and selfishness. The gold bracelet he has put on his arm is now constricting his dragon leg, and the pain is piercing. Even worse, the physical pain, mingled with the pain of realizing he's now cut off from humanity, isolated and alone. He begins to weep large, hot dragon tears. In mercy and compassion, Aslan arrives and leads the dragon Eustace to a garden on top of the mountain, and then to a well at the center of the garden. Eustace looks at the well and knows if he can get into the water, the pain in his leg would be soothed. But Aslan says he will have to be undressed first. After a moment of confusion, Eustace, remembering he's a dragon and that dragons have skins like snakes that could be shed. So with his new claws, Eustace begins tearing at his dragon skin. He peels off one layer only to discover another nasty, scaly and rough layer underneath. And then another. After three layers, he realizes it's vain. He will never make himself clean or get rid of his pain or shed the nasty skin. You see the insight of C.S. Lewis. We try and get rid of this sin ourselves. We cannot do it. And then comes the section she calls a gash of grace. You will have to let me undress you, says Aslan the lion. So desperate was Eustace, even his fear of Aslan's claws was not enough to stop him from laying flat down on his back and laying anxious on the ground. Here's what Eustace felt. And this is what he says to the other children when he meets them later. And this is dealing with sin. The very first tear he made was so deep, I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, as smooth and soft as a peeled switch and smaller than I had been, born again. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath. Now I got no skin on, and he threw me into the water. This baptism? It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I turned into a boy again. After a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me in new clothes. If you can't read that, it says, I never knew the world until I saw it through your eyes. I never knew myself until I ripped off my disguise. And the lady goes on, I have cried many tears of sober gratitude at the grace in this scene. It stings and it heals. So an interface with God means an awareness of our own need, of His greatness, discovery of our sin, and the pain of dealing with sin. It's an amazing thing, these opposites. And paradox lies deep at the heart of the gospel, has been said several times. And I think of amazing grace. And I like the two lines. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear. There's a sense in which I hope you have a sense of fear. We're going to meet God. And C.S. Lewis uses the lion, Aslan, as the person of Christ. Very wisely, because there's a sense of fear in meeting a lion. It was grace that taught my heart to fear. And grace, my fears relieved. So danger, but a friend zone. Meeting with God, awareness of sin, and coming, you see, Aslan, that says he's not safe, but he's good, from C.S. Lewis. So we find that for Isaiah, it might be different for you, but for Isaiah, the hot coal came off the altar, the place of sacrifice, and Isaiah is born again, purified and cleansed, born from above. But beware! It's getting serious. Because when we have an encounter with God, and we have an awareness of our sin, and we let God deal with us, there's still danger. Because what does he say? Who will go for us? And Isaiah hears of the need, and he volunteers, and he says, here am I, send me. Oh, sorry. I've got to go back, I think, here. All right. I like the story of the slave who was in chains in the slave market, and a man came along and paid the price for him and unlocked the chains and said, you are free. And the slave fell down on his knees before the man and said, you have set me free. I will serve you forever. And this is the danger when we really meet with God and we have sin dealt with and there is this need, there is that, I will serve you forever. But warning, elements of failure. Go and tell this people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving. You know, it's hard for a preacher. I mean, how much do you understand? How can I get through to you? I don't know. And God said, well, they won't. They won't understand. They can't see. They haven't a clue. Oh. And that could end up with despair for the poor prophet and preacher. Then I said, for how long, O Lord? And he said, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged. That's that element of service for the Lord. You warned. But we need to persevere until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. Keep on keeping on. Never give up. I suppose all of us have heard of Churchill when he was asked to give the prize-giving address at a school. And if you've been in prize-giving addresses at schools, they're totally boring. Most people fall asleep and so on. And they go on too long. But when it came time for Churchill's speech, he went up, got to the microphone, and he said, never give up. Never, never, never. And he sat down. We remember that one, don't we? We remember that. And this is it. It's going to be tough serving. It is going to be tough. Sometimes we think it's all going to be, it's wonderful. If you want to live a dangerous life, adventurous life, you don't have to bungee jump. Become a Christian. But there is with the Lord always a glimmer of hope. And this is puzzling. We could spend time on this, but I won't. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and oak leaf stumps when they're cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. And this, in a sense, is seen by many as the prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. But it's that wonderful thing. All dealings with God, there's hope. There is hope. I love it when, you know, you see a bushfire and everything's black and burned and desolate. And you go back 3 years later and you see green shoots coming through. There is always hope. So we meet with God. We see his true greatness. We see our own sinfulness. We receive his cleansing. We respond, use me, and we serve him no matter what. He's not safe, but he's good. Amen.